in session, Judge Reyes, Judge Sleater, Judge Bryan, and the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning, and we are at the tail end of the morning. Today is Wednesday, October 5th, 2022. We have six cases on our calendar for today. Five are set for oral argument. This is the fourth one. And this is case number A22-0625, Luke Mitchell. And my apologies if I mispronounce the name, Reventish. Okay, thank you. Versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. When you approach the podium, you can please, if you can please pronounce your name and your client's name, and let us know how you'd like us to refer to you and to your client during the argument this morning. All other rules of decorum, court decorum, apply. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Isabel McClure on behalf of Luke Mitchell Reventish. I'm comfortable with the court referring to me by my first name or as Ms. McClure, and my client is Mr. Reventish.
Okay. Thank you.
This case is before the court following a denial of Mr. Reventish's petition to revoke the rescission of his driver's license under Minnesota's implied consent law. This case presents the court with the opportunity to reinforce the principle that an officer must have reasonable, articulable suspicion in order to request a driver submit to a preliminary breath test. Here, the district court erred in its conclusion that the officer who requested Mr. Reventish submit to the preliminary breath test had the requisite reasonable suspicion. The court evaluates reasonable suspicion on a case-by-case basis, looking at the totality of the circumstances. The commissioner has cited to three bases for the conclusion that the officer had sufficient reasonable suspicion to request Mr. Reventish submit to the preliminary breath test. The first is the presence of a car accident. The second is the odor of alcohol. And the third is the admission that Mr. Reventish had been drinking. I will address each basis in turn, and then conclude with an analysis of how the totality of the circumstances did not yield sufficient reasonable suspicion for the officer to request that Mr. Reventish submit to a preliminary breath test.
And before you get into each one, if we're looking at the totality of the circumstances and there are three factors that the district court looked at, why isn't that sufficient? Why do we need to get into the minutia of each factor?
Well, Your Honor, it's not enough to simply have a list of potential factors.
It's not potential factors. These are the factors that the district court looked at and considered and relied upon to say that the officer did have reasonable articulable suspicion.
Because when you break them down and you look at each in turn, none would sufficiently or at the sum of their parts be enough to form suspicion of impairment. And so it's...
But that's my concern is... breaking them down into their individual parts. If we're supposed to look at the totality of circumstances, what case law allows us to break each apart and say, this alone is not enough, this one alone is not enough, this one alone is not enough, therefore, there's not reasonable articulable suspicion. That seems contrary to us having to look at the totality of circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor, to use a mathematical analogy, 0 + 0 + 0 would still be 0 at the end of the day.
True, but 1 + 1 + 1 = 3.
Right. And most of the cases cited by the commissioner and cited in our brief do break down each factor individually before analyzing on a totality of the circumstances, because each individual factor can either augment reasonable suspicion or diminish reasonable suspicion. And it's not uncommon for courts to say, well, maybe the reasonable suspicion started here, but then this factor brought it down. And so moving through the case step by step analyzing each factor as it was presented to the officer here to arrive at the totality of the circumstances, I think is helpful to determine whether the officer had reasonable suspicion or not.
Okay, fair enough.
So looking first to the car accident, by the officer's own admission, through her testimony, she could not determine who was at fault here. And that's important because,
she wouldn't opine as to who was at fault, but the circumstances of the accident would seem to indicate that appellant was at fault, wouldn't it? Based on who hit whom.
Potentially in a civil context, such as reclaiming on damages to the vehicle, but as far as who was at fault determining driving conduct, even if you have a driver who might hit another car from behind, if that driver slammed on their brakes out of nowhere or stopped at a green light, that's not necessarily at fault as far as indicative of impairment. It may be at fault for, again, a civil claim of damage to property or personal injury. But in this case, what we're looking at is, does this type of accident give rise to a suspicion that a driver was impaired? And because the officer could not opine, she didn't see what had happened, that conduct, whatever conduct caused the accident, would not form the basis of reasonable suspicion here. She didn't see it.
Ms. McClure, I'm going to ask you about a case I didn't see in your brief, and I don't think I saw it in the state's case, because I am kind of going back to these individual elements versus the totality. It's State versus Larry Dale Taylor, and I'm sorry I don't have the site, but the Supreme Court, I know the case because I was on our panel, and we were affirmed, but I was in a dissent on our panel. But the point being is, the question always is there one or more indicia of alcohol? And that was an expansion case as well, though it was a criminal case, but expansion, I believe it was criminal, maybe it wasn't, no, same as this. And the car was stopped with snow on the plate. The officer comes up to the officer notes that the licensed or the registered owner, which is the driver, had canceled inimical to public safety. And then the officer walks up and noticed there was an open case of beer with some beer missing in the back. But there was no observations of any indicia of any alcohol. There was no driving behavior. There was nothing that would, as you just pointed out, would demonstrate impairment. And yet, the Supreme Court affirmed the 2-1 majority in our court that was sufficient with no, and then I'll just read you the quote, and it was referring to the Lee case, which both of you do cite to us, the standard one. Thus, Lee unequivocally stands for the proposition that no bright line requires an officer to observe one of the physical indicia of intoxication to establish either probable cause or the lower standard of reasonable articulable suspicion that is at issue here. So wouldn't it be true that in your client's case, we wouldn't necessarily have to look at the totality and none of them would have to have the indicia of intoxication, but when you put it all together, that it's reasonable to inquire further about it, which is essentially what the district court ruled.
Right. In Taylor, I think Taylor is a little bit distinguishable. So in Taylor, that stop was conducted, I think it was in February, and the officer himself said, it was so cold, his fingers were going numb when he was trying to speak with the driver. It would have been very difficult to smell anything in that context. He had to have the driver wait in the car. It was too cold to even safely perform field sobriety tests, which he did fail. And I think in that case, I suppose I align more with Justice Thiessen's dissent. But in that case...
I could say I did. Two of them. He didn't win the day, and so obviously that's our precedent today.
Right. But in that case, the suspicion of present impairment was that there was that open box of beer within the driver's reach, and the expansion in that case wasn't actually the PBT request. The expansion in that case was, have you had any of those beers to drink? To which Mr. Taylor replied, I have. So it's a slightly different expansion in this case. Obviously asking Mr. Rebentish if he had had any alcohol, to which he did reply, I had some vodka about 6 hours prior. In the Taylor case, it's more indicative of present impairment because, again, that box was in the car. I believe the majority opinion said it's very easy for drivers to throw cans of beer out the window when they're driving. So there was more of an indicia of present impairment in the Taylor case than is present in Mr. Rebentish's case. And I mean, you're exactly correct, John. At the end of the day, the Supreme Court did say that canceled inimical to public safety, which is not at issue here. The court did say that is a pattern of driving while impaired. And if there's someone who's been canceled for driving while impaired with an open box of alcohol in their car, that's sufficient. And neither of those factors are present here.
Is there authority for the idea that an admission of past use is not enough to expand or not enough for reasonable suspicion?
I haven't seen an authority directly on point to that, but I could contrast it with the two cases the state has cited to state that there isn't a distinction between consumption and impairment. Those cases are State v. Rood and State v. Vevering. And in those cases, the commissioner cites in her brief to the proposition that the court was affirmatively saying there's no difference between consumption and impairment when we're talking about admission. But in both of those cases, again, factually distinct. In Rood, there was a spilled drink in the car of a driver who had just been in a serious accident. And in Vevering, there were open beer cans in plain sight in the vehicle.
So I guess my question is more about reasonable suspicion as a standard and whether or not a prior admission could ever not be. Maybe if you said, I haven't had a drink in 3 years, but 3 years ago I was a raging alcoholic or something, maybe you could argue that that's not enough for reasonable suspicion because it's 3 years ago, right? But I'm wondering if there's any authority to get us to that proposition or to get us to the point you want us to be, which is to say his statement is too far in the past to be any indication of present impairment.
Well, you're,
from a reasonable suspicion standpoint, even something in the past is enough for reasonable suspicion that someone could still be presently impaired, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. That makes sense. I think case law has said again and again there's no rigid formula for these cases, and so it becomes challenging, and I don't ask the court today to draw a line. If it's over 2 hours in the past, that's far enough back. If it's over four, if it's over 10, if it was from last night.
What's the longest you're aware of where they said reasonable suspicion? Days?
I would doubt days, Your Honor. I don't have a number to put to it, but I think that's, again, this totality of the circumstances analysis when we have an officer saying she initially noticed no impairment, she didn't observe the driving conduct at issue, and then he's saying he had consumed alcohol about 6 hours prior. That's, again, very different than some of these cases that are cited in the commissioner's brief where there was actual drinking while driving going on. And I think that is a logical time for the court to say, no, there's no difference as far as reasonable suspicion between consumption and impairment when you are actively drinking while you're driving. But that same logic should not apply because, again, in the...
Doesn't this kind of get back to where Judge Reyes was at the beginning, that if you look at these two indicia together, the odor of alcohol when the mask is removed and an admission, that together the reasonable suspicion is, oh, it's not exactly 6 hours. It's going to be a shorter amount of time than that because 6 hours ago you probably wouldn't still have odor on your breath, right? So, but together there's a reasonable suspicion that might not be present under them separately.
Possibly, but again, the odor here is at issue. At first, the officer didn't smell and understand he was wearing a mask, but then speaking to the other driver who immediately said to the officer, oh, he has alcohol on his breath, which clued the officer into smelling it. And there's no contest to the credibility of the officer here, but just why she was necessarily looking for that and what motivation the other driver may have had to say to the officer, I smelled alcohol on him. I mean, clearly, the presumption would be if he was severely intoxicated, a lot of these cases, that are cited, the officers are noting a strong odor of alcohol, an odor of alcohol that's radiating from a person when they're speaking with them, and that wasn't the case here.
But I want to go back to the first factor of the accident itself. Didn't the officer say that based on the damage that the officer saw of the vehicles, that appellant rear-ended the other car?
My interpretation of the district court's order was that the officer didn't go so far as to say that he rear-ended the car, but she did note that the damage was at appellant, the front of Mr. Rebentish's car and the back of her car. And I think it's a fair inference to draw that he must have collided with the back of her vehicle at some point, but not necessarily, again, different than the civil standard. If she came to a screeching halt at a green light, which we don't know.
Right. The officer was clear to say, I didn't observe it, and I'm not going to opine as to fault. But the officer, my recollection, did say that it appears that appellant did rear-end the other party. And then, of course, the district court can make whatever, or the fact finder can make whatever inferences it wants to from that information. But you're going over case law, and I realize we just have a few seconds left, but isn't really the Messenberg case that recently issued last year, isn't that one relatively close? Because in that one, we concluded that the trooper had a reasonable suspicion to request a PBT based on, one, Messenberg speeding, two, detecting the odor of alcohol from Messenberg, and then three, Messenberg actually denying drinking. And it seems like the totality of circumstances here, it's very similar, but it's actually stronger because there he denied drinking. Here, appellant admitted to drinking.
Your Honor, I see my time has concluded. May I answer your question?
May.
Okay. Again, I think the driving conduct in Messenberg, the speeding, I think there was an allegation of some additional reckless driving in Messenberg, if I remember correctly. I think the odor was stronger in Messenberg. And my understanding of that case was the court ultimately did uphold the reasonable suspicion, but was mostly affirming the fact that reasonable suspicion was enough and there wasn't probable cause required to have a driver submit to a PBT. I think I could answer Your Honor's question better if I could review Messenberg and address it again on rebuttal, just to make sure I'm being accurate. And
not a problem
case.
At all.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Mezra. You may refer to me as Ms. Mezra or counsel. I am here on behalf of the respondent, the Commissioner of Public Safety, which may be just referred to as a commissioner. This case is about whether an officer can administer a preliminary breath test, commonly referred to as a PBT, to a driver who was involved in a traffic accident, exhibited an odor of alcohol, and admitted to drinking. I'd like to first address the question by Judge Sleater earlier on in this argument regarding State versus Taylor. State versus Taylor reaffirmed that there is no bright line or set standard of indicia that need to be present in order to find reasonable suspicion, and that you have to put all of the observations together to see if that makes it reasonable to suspect a possible impairment. And this case is stronger than the facts in Taylor. This case does have physical indicia of intoxication, namely the odor of alcohol. It also has driving conduct, or at the very least, involvement in a traffic accident, which can suggest impaired driving conduct, and it has an admission to drinking alcohol.
Can I ask you about the odor piece? Ms. McClure argues that because this was something that was clued, that the officer was clued into it because of something that the other driver of the other vehicle, the driver of the other vehicle said. Is there any authority limiting what inferences or what suspicion an officer can draw or can have based on statements of other people, including people who might be involved, like a victim?
Well, Your Honor, first, I'm not aware of any authority that states that an odor has to be a certain strength in order to consider it. And
That's not really my, my question is more about how, what is reasonable for an officer to do when they're provided information from somebody who might have an interest in the case, right? Is there some limitation on the suspicion that someone can draw from information gathered in that way?
Your Honor, I am unaware of any case that suggests that just because a person is involved in a traffic accident, that the information they're giving to an officer can't be relied on or used. Obviously, an officer in a situation has to make her own, you know, credibility determinations in terms of if what the person is saying is consistent with what she is viewing. Here, you had an individual who had been interacting with Mr. Urbanich during this incident, and when just giving her report of what she said happened in this accident, stated that she believed that Mr. Urbanich smelled like alcohol and that he possibly was under the influence. And that's what caused Officer Coffey, still taking a traffic accident report at this time, to go back and talk to Mr. Urbanich, and then she smelled the odor of alcohol herself. And if you look at the district court's record, Officer Coffey, in articulating her, you know, reasonable suspicion and articulating why she administered a PBT, she didn't say it's because this other person said that she smelled alcohol. She said it's because I smelled alcohol coming from him, and then he admitted to consuming alcohol, and he was involved in this traffic accident. So the report from the other party is relevant context, but it's not any sole basis and for what Officer Coffey did, and she also was able to corroborate it through her own senses by smelling the odor coming from the party.
Ms. Mesra, isn't it true from the record, though, that but for that statement, there's nothing that we can see from the record or even the judge at the appellate consent hearing that absent that, she had concerns about alcohol consumption or impairment?
That's correct, Your Honor, that Officer Coffey did not have any concerns of impairment up until that point. There's nothing in the record to suggest that she would not have gone back and talked to Mr. Urbanich a second time just in general. She's there taking a traffic accident report. Both parties are still there. At first, she was just initially getting both sides of, you know, the story and what happened. It's very likely that she would still be talking with him in some way, and perhaps he removed the mask.
But the point being, there was nothing in his demeanor, his conversation, that he had the mask on, obviously, so she couldn't smell the odor. But the point being is there was nothing that, that raised any red flags until the other driver mentioned the smell of alcohol.
That's correct. That is my understanding of the record as well.
And hence, in this case, when he drank was probably irrelevant because your argument would be, and Stacey Taylor would suggest, once she had that smell and we already had the accident, the PBT was a reasonable, there was a reasonable basis to ask for the PBT.
I would argue, Your Honor, even absent his admission, there'd still be reasonable suspicion here, but obviously we have the admission, and the admission was, I think the transcript says about noon that day, and I believe if you look at the timing of this, Officer Coffey arrives at the scene very shortly before 6 p.m., but then this accident happened prior to 6 p.m., and I believe the transcript and the district court order says the call came in around 5:30 p.m., which is making the accident closer in time to the admitted consumption.
Would you agree that then the bottom line is here, if there had been no odor, there would be, so we're, even though we're talking about totality, we're really looking at talking about alcohol, a smell of alcohol, because if you didn't have that, there'd be absolutely nothing for the officer to have believed that he was impaired.
So, Your Honor, I obviously this is not a single factor case, that we do have the three factors that the district court mentioned. The odor of alcohol is just what set off, you know, kind of the series of events that led to the reasonable suspicion. I'm not here arguing
the result of the PBT, obviously.
Yes. I'm not here arguing that the traffic accident in and of itself would be sufficient for reasonable suspicion, but that because there's this odor of alcohol that Officer Coffey was able to confirm, and the admission under the totality, that is enough reasonable suspicion for the PBT.
You did, in your briefing, you do seem to allude to the idea that odor of alcohol alone would be sufficient, though.
Your Honor, case law that I'm aware of states that odor of alcohol is an indication of intoxication, and it can be used as a basis for expansions into asking whether a person has been drinking alcohol or things of that nature. If I did, I hope I did not. I did not intend to argue that odor of alcohol alone would be sufficient. I think, again, the case law talks about it all depends on the totality of the circumstances. I am aware of no such case that there was only one factor present in the record for this court to find reasonable suspicion or probable cause, but there is language suggesting that it is possible that could happen depending on the case. And I don't believe it would be appropriate for this court to really necessarily go down the single factor road in this case, because we have three independent factors here.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your candor on that, because one of my concerns, quite frankly, is the original case law looked at in the 70s, Hicks and some of the progeny, there were actually four factors that they looked at, and then Hicks, I believe it was Hicks, said, or Simonson, said, well, we don't need to look at all four, as long as there's several, and then there are indications that, well, maybe only one, but it hasn't been clear cut, and it that seems contrary to the seminal cases in this area.
My understanding, I believe you're referring to Simonson, a Supreme Court opinion, if I'm correct. That case discussed the foundation for a lay witness to give an opinion as to intoxication, and the court listed various things that this person did not observe. They did not observe them walking, they did not observe them talking, an odor of alcohol, anything like that, and found that there was not sufficient basis for this person to give their opinion as to impairment. I read Hicks and Holtz and the opinions that come after to say, Simonson didn't say all of those things are required. It said those are possible bases someone can give for their opinion. And those cases clearly state that some people that are impaired can exhibit some signs and not others, but we do need to have some basis in terms of some signs that they are showing. And again, I'm aware of no case that's taken it all the way down to just one single factor. There's, in my read of the case law, there's always multiple factors at play. But the language suggests that there could be a case someday. I'm just not aware of it, and I don't believe this is a case here for that as well.
And that would be contrary to the idea of looking at the totality of the circumstances anyway. You're trying to look at all the factors as well.
In that hypothetical case, the totality of the circumstances would be one circumstance, and I am aware of no case that's come to that point yet. Here, I think this is a much closer case to the Messenberg decision of this court, which is very recent and precedential. Instead of speeding.
Can I ask a question about that, too? Again, getting back to the first question from Judge Reyes, and how separate do we consider these indicia? It seems to me that in Messenberg, the two things work together. The odor plus the denial raise some suspicion. What do you think about how these indicia can work together and whether in this case the sum of those two is greater than them individually?
Sure. So in Messenberg, I believe the trooper articulated that the odor he was smelling plus this denial, it wasn't adding up, that something was likely being hidden. Here we have an odor and an admission saying, yes, I was, you know, drinking out vodka, I believe it was specified earlier in the day. And while those two factors do point to the same conclusion that this is a possible impaired person, they are still separate factors. They just corroborate each other.
But I think the argument was when you look at them separately, the admission is an admission to something that's too far in the past for it to indicate present impairment, right? So in that sense, it is a little closer to a denial, right? That the suspicion really comes from the two not adding up.
Well, first, Your Honor, I would say I don't believe admission to consumption 6 hours prior is too far in the past to be considered as reasonable suspicion in this case. I believe there's some case law from this court that discusses admissions to consuming alcohol the night prior, and then there's a morning, traffic stop.
Right, but no bright line rule. You're just saying that there are some, whether published or unpublished, that are more than 6 hours that still count as reasonable suspicion.
Correct. Right. And I think sometimes in the admissions you get people articulating how much they've had to drink, whether it's, you know, a whole liter of vodka versus, you know, saying I only had one glass of wine. And it also would...
And sorry to stop you right there, but correct me if I'm wrong, but there's nothing in the record indicating how much he had drank.
That's correct. My review of the record is just he said he was drinking vodka. I don't believe he specified how much.
Okay. Thank you.
The idea that this is an admission that cannot be considered at all, I just think goes back to the Vivering case and the Rude case, talking about how there's the distinction we're trying to draw between individual indicia of mere consumption versus indicia of impairment is just not a sound analysis. And Vivering especially makes that clear in the context of reasonable suspicion, because we're only looking for articulable facts and not a higher standard of probable cause. And so the idea that we can pick apart each of these factors in the context of reasonable suspicion, especially under the Taylor case where the court looks at adding up everything we have together. I just don't believe that that's a sound analysis in this case.
Ms. Mesra, just to follow up Judge Bryan's point, wouldn't it be true that, and the reason I said earlier it became irrelevant is because she smelled it, isn't the more, the increased suspicion arises when an officer smells it and then there's a denial. So now that's inching up. Here, it seems like it's all one factor, in other words, because she already smelled it and he admitted what she smelled. And so it's only with the denial, then that doesn't add up. Now you got two factors because I can smell it and you're denying what I'm smelling.
So, Your Honor, I still believe that the admission is a separate factor because obviously you can have odor and not an admission or admission and not an odor. They are pointing to the same thing and they are cooperative. And I also think that the denial, it would still depend on an officer's ability to articulate what it was about a denial that led to the suspicion. Again, in Messenberg, the trooper clearly articulated he thought this person was trying to hide something. If somebody denies and then the trooper believes them, that might take that at least out of the equation or lower it in the equation.
But my point is no trooper's going to believe it if they smell the alcohol, right? So
unless there's some very obvious source of it or explanation for it that can be given credibly, I don't believe that that was the case in Messenberg, and obviously it's not the case here as well. But there could be a circumstance where there's an odor of alcohol but a plausible explanation for it that an officer believes. I'm aware of no such case of that, but I could see that as a possible future case.
If potentially, for instance, somebody is diabetic and gives off what may appear to be a smell of alcohol, but in fact it is not. Ketosis is what comes. I don't know if that's the correct one, but
my understanding of the diabetes issue is that it's acetone on the breath, and that usually comes in terms of the alcohol testing, the breath testing, in terms of if it's possibly interfering with it or not. I'm not actually sure if the acetone has its own smell. I'm just unfamiliar with.
It does have its own smell.
Okay. and in that case, a person saying, I have diabetes, and is trying to explain the odor of alcohol that way. Again, it's within the totality of the circumstances. It would depend on other factors going on at the time and the officer's belief or disbelief of that explanation, depending on what they were observing. If there are no more questions, I see my time is almost up. I would just close by saying the district court did not err in this case in finding that the officer had reasonable suspicion to administer the PBT based on the three factors we have discussed, and I'd ask this court to affirm the district court ruling in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I think to Judge Bryan and to Judge Sleater's point on Messenberg, it does seem that something doesn't add up here was the factor. I believe in Messenberg the officer did, as is common in these cases, say he had the strong odor of alcohol immediately upon pulling this driver over for speeding. And when the driver said, "I haven't been drinking," something didn't add up for him. Versus in this case, we don't even have the immediate odor of alcohol. That only came after speaking with the other driver, and then an admission. And I want to clarify, it's not appellant's position today that the court has to decide that, oh, any time a driver says, "Oh, I was drinking 5 or 6 hours prior," that's not sufficient for reasonable suspicion. I believe that there are cases where a driver could have been drinking the night before and was still intoxicated, there would still be reasonable suspicion the next day. It's just that in this case, when we look at all the other indicia that aren't present, he was not slurring his speech, he wasn't...
But counsel, if I may stop you there, do we need to look at what is not present, or do we just look at what is present and whether that is sufficient to support reasonable articulable suspicion?
The totality of the circumstances analysis would also include what is not present. And I think it's also...
What case law supports that approach?
There's a case cited in State v. Taylor that was also analyzed in State v. Lee. And I apologize to the court, I cannot remember the name off the top of my head. But State v. Lee was one of those cases where there was only one factor present, just the accident. And the analysis was just by the nature of this accident, there must have been impairment. And actually, I believe there was a discussion in Lee analyzing at least what wasn't available to the officer, but of course the court did find probable cause for the blood draw warrant in that case. But I think it, even without necessarily a cite to authority, totality of the circumstances, it would make sense that it's not just what is in front of us, but what isn't. Because I think when you compare factually these cases, when you have a driver who's slurring their words, who's having a hard time concentrating, who's behaving erratically, who's swaying, that is, even without deviating from the court's precedent that, yes, there can be a single factor, and there's no argument today that that shouldn't be the case. But in this case, because there wasn't, because we could, you can look at the absence of certain factors, and this sounds a bit bizarre, as the presence of others, clear eyes, clear speech, normal behavior, good balance, all of these things that are atypical of cases where officers are encountering drivers that they suspect of being impaired.
But isn't that really contrary to, I think it was 73 or 74 when Simonson came out, Hicks, 73 and Hicks as well, where the Supreme Court said, we don't need to find all the indicia. And wasn't that really part of its acknowledgement that you may have indicia in certain cases and you may not have in others? So one person, one drink, they may be slurring their speech, but somebody who, you know, is suffers from the disease of alcoholism may be able to drink quite a bit without any obvious signs of impairment other than the smell of alcohol. So you may not see or hear slurred speech. You may not see stumbling when they're walking. You may not notice any other indicia. So that's why I question whether we should be looking at what is not there, because that may not necessarily be helpful. Aren't we really looking at, is there enough there to support the reasonable suspicion that the officer has does not have?
I think in this case, because, again, we have an admission of some sort of consumption, so we know at some point he did consume alcohol. It's not necessarily a question of had he consumed alcohol or not. We have the admission, but it's a question of was he impaired. So, of course, there are certain cases where it's not prudent or relevant to look for factors that weren't present, but I think here the odor clearly was not strong enough for the officer to notice it upon our first interaction.
Well, I don't know if we can assume that, because he was wearing a mask. So wouldn't that inhibit the officer from being able to detect the smell of alcohol?
Potentially, absolutely. It's just, it differs from these other cases where there's this immediate strong sense of odor. And again, it's a case-by-case analysis where you have the odor, this accident that the officer said is not necessarily indicative of impairment. I see my time has finished. May I conclude?
Briefly conclude, yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And then this admission of prior consumption far back in time, coupled with no other indicia of impairment, we respectfully ask the court to reverse the conclusion of the district court and hold that the officer did not have sufficient reasonable suspicion to request that Mr. Rebentisch submit to the preliminary breath test. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. Very well argued, and we appreciate the discussion that you had with all of us here. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both.